chill wind blows on a black night. The place, Washington, D.C., the capital of a divided nation. It has been a rain-filled April. Pennsylvania Avenue is awash with mud and muck. The city sleeps, but it's a mournful sleep. One of those who mourns is the wife of the President of the United States. Abraham Lincoln has been assassinated. This week, we observe the 100th anniversary of the death of Abraham Lincoln. So let us go back 100 years ago and relive those days. Let us meet the people who walked in the shadow of Lincoln. Some who loved him, some who hated him. Finally, let us meet the plotters who, history says, created the drama that rang down the curtain on the final hours of Lincoln's life. These are the last days of Lincoln.
The Last Days of Lincoln. This series is brought to you by Twin City Federal, headquarters for savings accounts, home loans, and home improvement loans. And by the Lincoln National Life Insurance Company of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and your Lincoln Life general agents in the Twin Cities, Lynn M. Elling and Associates of Minneapolis, James J. Sheehan and Associates, St. Paul. Now, 100 years ago, the last days of Lincoln.
The events that led to the firing of that fatal bullet back on that night of April 14th, 1865, began taking form months before the shot was heard. And historians still disagree about much of the circumstances. What we know today about the Lincoln story is part fact, part fiction. But there is no disagreement on one thing, that Lincoln's assassination, although shocking, was not completely unexpected. Although the bloody conflict between North and South was finally drawing to its close, the nation, what was left of it, was in turmoil. Lincoln, hated and defamed by some elements of both North and South, walked a shaky line in history. No sooner had he been inaugurated than James Gordon Bennett, editor of the New York Herald, made this prediction.
If Lincoln persists in his present position, in the teeth of such results as his election must produce, he will totter into a dishonored grave, perhaps driven there by the hands of an assassin.
And there was no shortage of would-be assassins. Some openly advertised their services in at least one southern newspaper. And Lincoln's desk was crammed with threatening notes and letters. And so, even months before Lincoln's life would end, the drama was beginning to unravel. The cast of characters is long, headed, of course, by Abraham Lincoln himself, who would become a martyr for his nation. There was Mary Lincoln, his wife, a woman badly abused and misunderstood by history. There was Secretary of War Edwin McMaster Stanton, stubborn and tough. Another member of the cast, William H. Seward, who felt the slash of an assassin's knife, but lived to tell about it. The villains? There were many, but more about them later. First, we must examine the stage itself. And in 1865, the stage was the city of Washington. On those April days, the nation's capital was the scene of noisy celebration and general bedlam. The Civil War was being won, and the Union was winning it. If you were on the Union side, you were glad. But if your convictions lay with the South, you were mad. And in Washington that April, you could find both kinds. A month earlier, on a rain-splashed morning, President Lincoln had taken note of this in his inaugural address.
Both sides deprecated war. But one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive. And the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. Both read the same Bible and prayed to the same God, and each invoked his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any man should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not that we...
Lincoln's second inaugural address lasted less than 5 minutes, and his final words had special meaning.
With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
Even as President Lincoln addressed the inaugural audience, his eyes might have seen a handsome young man standing a few feet away, listening intently. His name, John Wilkes Booth. Career, actor. Ambition, murder. But his time had not yet come. Springtime in Washington, and the bright sun, which managed to break through gathering storm clouds once in a while, cheered the people of the city. The streets, slippery and treacherous with mud, rang with the sound of the horse teams and wagons. Shouts cascaded into the streets from the crowded taverns, where one and all met to erase the sound of the war, a feeling of tension with beer, brandy, and good old-fashioned corn whiskey. Even the stately hotels, frequented by statesmen and scoundrel alike, were enveloped in the prevailing spirit of hustle and bustle. From the eight main roadways that connected Washington with the rest of the country came a colorful kind of people. Washington burst at the seams as the city greeted returning Union soldiers, Confederate prisoners, newly freed slaves, blackguards, cutthroats, and all manner of men. And even as the population of the capital swelled, the war between the states was drawing to its conclusion. The cannonade continued, but with less vigor than in the bloody months which had already become history. The dusty banners of the Union snapped southward out of Fredericksburg, westward out of Old Point, northward out of Savannah, and eastward out of Lynchburg. The noose was tightened with each passing hour. The city to watch was Petersburg. When that fell, the final kill would occur at Richmond. The South fought with valiance and empty bellies. The Union fought with General Ulysses S. Grant, a man who understood the value of sheer numbers. The end came on April 2nd, when Confederate President Jefferson Davis fled from Richmond along with members of his cabinet. President Lincoln was in City Point, Virginia, when the Confederacy gave up the ghost. And even though the long-awaited day had come, no one in the North knew about it until the following day, when Lincoln sent a coded message to Secretary of War Stanton. Two Army telegraph operators in Washington read the message in near disbelief before throwing open the windows and shouting the news to the people on the streets.
Hey, you people out there, Richmond is ours! President Lincoln says so!
Yippee! And Petersburg is down the drain, too!
The Union has won this dang war!
The cry was carried through the city. Young boys dashed down Pennsylvania Avenue, passing the word and bumping into people. In a public park, a battery of guns was limbering up when the word came. The captain became so excited, he ordered an immediate salute of 800 rounds. 300 for Petersburg, 500 for Richmond. Courts adjourned, stranger hugged stranger, and business in the taverns turned into a frenzy. It was a joyous moment for the North, but a mortifying moment for the South. But on both sides, the sighs of relief were quick in coming. It had been a long, costly war, a senseless war. A week later, General Robert E. Lee surrendered the tattered remnants of his army to General Grant. And the Secretary of War, Stanton, had this to say to the Northern general.
Thanks be to Almighty God for the great victory with which he has this day crowned you and the gallant army under your command. The brave and gallant officers of your army deserve the reverence of the War Department, the government, and of all the people of these reunited states. May they deserve this honor for all time.
Solemn words at a solemn moment. President Lincoln delivered his formal victory address a few days later. In the audience, same as before, was a handsome young man who listened closely to Lincoln's every word. Again, that man was John Wilkes Booth, and the plot to erase Lincoln from this earth was already well underway.
was almost as if Lincoln had a premonition of what lay ahead. The night of his victory speech, Lincoln sat with his wife, Mary, and a few friends in the Red Room of the Executive Mansion. The fare was tea and cakes. It was 10 o'clock. The talk turned to that of dreams. Lincoln turned to Mary.
Nowadays, dreams are regarded as very foolish, and they're seldom told except by old women and by young men and maidens in love.
Why, do you believe in dreams?
I can't say that I do. But I had one the other night, which has haunted me ever since.
For some reason, that frightens me.
Well, I probably should never have mentioned it in the first place.
The president tried to change the subject, sorry now that he'd brought it up at all. But Mary had to know what the dream was about. And so Lincoln told about his dream, how he had awakened in the middle of the night to the sound of sobs, as if a number of people were weeping. He dressed and went into the East Room to find a throng of people looking upon a body.
I turned to a guard and asked, "Who is dead at the White House?" And the soldier replied, "The president. He was killed by an assassin." Anyway, I can't get the dream out of my mind.
Oh, that's horrid. I wish now you'd never told me about it. I'm glad I don't believe in dreams, or I'd be in terror from now on.
Oh, it was only a dream. Let's say no more about it. Try and forget it.
At this point, President Lincoln had less than a week to live, and he didn't know that, and he probably wished he hadn't brought the dream to his wife's attention. Mary Lincoln could get easily upset. She was a high-strung, busy woman, given to great flights of joy and the lowest depths of depression. And although historians may disagree about this woman, they agree at least on one point. Mary Lincoln dearly loved her husband. At this stage of his life, with the closing curtain poised to ring down, the president was 35 pounds underweight. His friends said he walked like a man whose feet hurt. At 56, Lincoln looked old and sick. He had fought as hard as any soldier in the field to reunite the states. Now and then, he allowed a coachman to assist him in and out of his carriage. Mary Lincoln loved to take afternoon carriage rides, and she tried to encourage Abe to come along, and sometimes he did.
Abe, can't you just smell spring in the air? I'm so happy on a day like this. It just makes you feel good all deep down inside.
Mother, I think you're right.
Well, then, Abe, we ought to do this more often. You haven't been looking well lately, and a little fresh air may be just what you need.
Oh, I don't look all that bad. Besides, I was never much of a looker anyway, so how can you tell the difference? I'll just let this beard grow a little longer, and it'll give me a good fence to hide behind.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with your looks, Abe, that a little fattening up wouldn't help.
Well, now, Mother, don't you worry about me none. The good Lord above has got his eyes on both of us. Handsome, ugly, tall, skinny, or fat, it's all the same to him.
A pleasant carriage ride on a spring afternoon, winding through the streets of Washington. President Lincoln, relaxed and thoughtful. Mary Lincoln, quiet and attentive. And then there was the theater. Mary loved a party. She was a clever hostess, and she loved the romance and the mystery of the theater party most of all. There were two leading theaters in the nation's capital. There was Grover's, and there was Ford's Theater. Seated in the presidential box alongside her husband, Mary Lincoln would thrill as the latest drama to reach Washington unwound on the stage below. The president wasn't nearly the theater buff his wife was, but he sat stoically through many a play.
Theodore, my own, let it never be said that our love was not worth all the tribulation of the universe, and that the beating of our own two hearts as one mimics the soft flutter of an angel's wings.
Ah, 'tis true, my fair one, and though the pages of history be turned down through the passing ages, our love will be surpassed by no other.
Then let us marry so that we may...
Isn't she just glorious, Abe?
Having to sit through scenes like that didn't exactly endear Lincoln to either Ford's or Grover's theater. But how could Lincoln have known, in that second week of April in 1865, that he would go to the theater but once more, and it would be the last theater appearance he would ever make?
100 years ago this week, Abraham Lincoln died. We'll return to our story in just 1 minute. Springtime is home buying time. If you're checking around looking for a home to buy, get a little expert help on your side. Check with your real estate man. He knows the most about what homes are for sale in this area. Then check with the Twin City Federal man. He knows the most about home financing. He can help you decide how much home you can afford to buy. He can advise you on which type of home financing is best for you. He can tell you about down payments and monthly payments. For 42 years, Twin City Federal has been helping families in all income brackets buy homes. It would welcome an opportunity to help you. 8th and Marquette is the Twin City Federal address in Minneapolis, 6th and Robert in St. Paul. Suburban offices in Anoka, Robbinsdale, Excelsior, Edina, Southdale, and Harmar Mall in Roseville. Move up to the best home you can afford with the help of the best home financing experience in this area.
The soldiers kept coming home. With the great Civil War mostly in the past now, they came straggling into Washington from all directions, tired and tattered, torn and tumbled. They came by foot, by horse, and by wagon. These were the lucky ones. They escaped with their lives. More than 500,000 men and young boys from both North and South were the unlucky ones. They paid with their lives. Their bodies littered torn forests and meadows. Those that headed for Washington were in a celebrating mood.
Charlie, I tell you, I never knew one city could look so good in these tired old eyes.
Sammy, I hear you talking, and do you know what I'm going to do first of all?
Yeah, have a good old snort of some of that good capital whiskey.
No, that comes later. First off, I'm going to get me a bath with lots of hot water and that smelly soap. Man, I can feel it now. Woo! I've been smelling like a polecat for so long, I can't take it much longer.
Yeah, well, you're just sensitive, soldier. I've gotten kind of used to the way I smell. You might even say it's sort of become part of my natural-born character. Yeah.
And so, the soldiers straggled in and out of town. At first, they were an oddity, but as the days rolled by, the citizens of Washington began taking them for granted, paying the new arrivals no mind. And there were other arrivals in Washington who were overlooked as well. Unfortunately, those who conspired against Lincoln were among them. There were fortune hunters, blockade runners, and crackpots. There were the disgruntled wastes that rise to the surface after any war. And there were many of them in the Capitol. Worse yet, there were many reasons why someone might want to take the life of the nation's president. Vengeance, because the South lost the war. Racial, because Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation had freed the slaves. Political, because Lincoln represented only the minority, even in his own party. And those who might have had an eye on Lincoln's life came from both North and South. This ad appeared in the Salem, Alabama Dispatch newspaper.
If the citizens of the Southern Confederacy will furnish me with the cash or good securities for the sum of $1,000,000, I will cause the lives of Abraham Lincoln, William H. Seward, and Andrew Johnson to be taken. This will give us peace and satisfy the world that cruel tyrants cannot live in the land of liberty. If this is not accomplished, nothing will be claimed beyond the sum of $50,000 in advance, which is supposed to be necessary to reach and slaughter the three villains. I will myself give $1,000 toward this patriotic purpose.
And so, threats against the life of President Lincoln became common knowledge, on the tip of every tongue, and the plotters were at work. Not with precision, because history would record their deeds as a series of bumblings. Lincoln could not know this, but in the last days of his life, he may have had an inkling of what was to come. Let's take a case in point. During that last final week of his life, President Lincoln set out upon a leisurely evening stroll. He was headed for the War Department, which was a stone's throw from the White House. Joining him in the walk was Crook, a dedicated police officer, a guard whose job it was to watch over the life of Lincoln. The pair walked up Pennsylvania Avenue and collided with a group of celebrants, lusty men enjoying their spirits as a leftover fruit of war. After the two men had passed by the group, Lincoln paused in thought.
Crook, do you know I believe there are men who want to take my life, and I have no doubt they will do it.
Why do you think so, Mr. President?
Other men have been assassinated.
I hope you're mistaken.
Oh, I have perfect confidence in those around me, in every one of you men. But if it is to be done, it's impossible to prevent it.
It wasn't the first time that President Lincoln had voiced such thoughts. It had happened before.
I do not consider that I have ever accomplished anything without God. And if it is his will that I must die by the hand of an assassin, I must be resigned. I must do my duty as I see it, and leave the rest to God.
And Lincoln, the rail splitter, had more to say on the same subject. He met with Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, and his mind rode the same rail.
Whichever way the war ends, I have the impression that I shall not last long after it is over.
And as the days drifted by, aiming for a conclusion that fate had designed, the President, Lincoln, could not remove the thoughts from his head.
I'll do the very best I know how, the very best I can, and I mean to keep doing so until the end. If the end brings me out all right, what is said against me won't amount to anything. If the end brings me out wrong, 10 angels swearing I was right will make no difference.
And so Lincoln, Abe, the Kentucky and Illinois traveler, led his life down the one-way path. There was the question of the slaves, which Abe settled with his decree of emancipation, and he gained new enemies by his support of that very document.
As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. When I see strong hands sowing, reaping, and threshing wheat into bread, I cannot refrain from wishing and believing that those hands someday, in God's good time, shall own the mouth they feed.
And with every word that Lincoln uttered, his enemies, and they were many, consumed more fuel for their dread designs. Talk about the slaves, talk about the war. There was no president, even Lincoln, who could broach the subjects without gaining enemies.
War at its best is terrible. And this war of ours, in its magnitude and its duration, is one of the most terrible. It has deranged business. It has destroyed property and ruined homes. It has produced a national debt and taxation without precedent. It has carried mourning to almost every home until it can almost be said that the heavens are hung in black. We accepted this war for an object, a worthy object. And the war will end when the object is attained. Under God, I hope it will never end until that time.
And the war did not end before that time, but when it did, the losses were staggering. Would it gain the North? Would it gain the South? Would it gain the Union? Would the states be once again united? These were the questions which begged for an answer during the fateful month in April 1865. Not only did the Union's life hang in the balance, but so too did the life of Lincoln hang in the balance. The Union's life could be saved, but as far as fate was concerned, the life of Lincoln could not be saved. But weary as Lincoln was during those last final unrecoverable days, his final hours with his loved ones gave him restful moments. His eldest son, Robert, was back from the war, and there was Tad, young, enthusiastic, despite handicaps which would finally claim his life. The few moments the family spent together could never be erased, not even by the black events which would follow.
Now, don't be so stingy, Abe. Let the boy have a few more cakes if he wants them. Lord knows it's hard enough to get him to eat as it is.
That's what the fellas in the troops say, Father. If you weigh less than 70 pounds, you've got regular approval for all the cakes you can stow in.
Well, it's not a matter of how many cakes Tad eats, but he won't eat the edges and leaves half of them on his plate.
Well, never you mind, Abe. The boy eats less enough as it is. And if it wasn't for Robert being home and all, he probably wouldn't be eating at all now anyway.
Mother, I'm a miser. I can't help it. I was just built that way. Way back in Kentucky, when I was a lot younger than Tad, the folks used to say that I wouldn't slap a bee because I might waste the sting. That's the way I am. I can't help it.
Even as the family enjoyed its breakfast together, the city of Washington bustled outside. The smell of wood smoke filled the streets. Ducks and chickens picked their way along Pennsylvania Avenue. Pigs wallowed and grunted in the puddles. These were good times, aside from the blood of the war,
Bricklayers were getting $2.50 for a day's work and were demanding a dollar raise. Freed slaves were paid $11 a month in keep for field work. The highest priced meats were ham, 28 cents a pound, and turkey at 30. You could get a barrel of Boston crackers, enough to last a season, for a little over $6. The favorite whiskeys were Baker 1851, Oberholtz 1855, Ziegler, and Finale. Hoop skirts wholesaled for a dollar apiece. Corsets cost $1.50 or $1.75 for extra strong ones. Washington City, a place of cobblestones and iron wheels, bayonets and bonnets. From almost any point in the city, your eye could pick out the Capitol and the Washington Monument. Among the more prominent institutions were a penitentiary, 24 military hospitals, an insane asylum, a huge poorhouse, and assortment of low and medium-priced houses of prostitution, and a score of gambling houses. Then, of course, there was the Washington police force, 50 men strong who were paid by the city, and there were 50 more who were paid by the federal government. In their hands lay the awesome job of protecting a president whose life, during the second week in April 1865, hung by a slender thread. Security for the president was practically nil, but it had improved somewhat since the day when he first entered Washington. He had a cavalry detail for presidential escort. There was a small White House guard. Conspiracies to kidnap or murder Lincoln had become open secrets, and the prime duty of protecting the president of the United States fell to Secretary of War Stanton and Colonel Lafayette C. Baker, head of the Federal Secret Service.
Colonel Baker, I'm sure you understand what we face here. President Lincoln's protection must be increased in light of reports of probable plots against his life.
Well, I understand perfectly, Secretary Stanton, but you must understand that this is no easy task. President Lincoln dislikes pomp and ceremony. It takes months to get him used to a cavalry escort. Our men in plain clothes he doesn't mind, but he wants no pretentious display.
Well, I care not for what the president cares to call display. The fact is, we both agree his life could be in danger. We must take extra care. I can't even bear to think of Friday night. Mrs. Lincoln has it in her head to see the theater, and despite my pleas, the president won't refuse her wish. He asked me to go. I said I would not. And I said, furthermore, that he should not go either.
And now what do you suggest?
Well, I suggest we tighten the guard even more closely. If I can't talk Lincoln out of that theater appearance, we'll have to be doubly careful.
When are they supposed to see the theater next?
No, it'll probably be next Friday, the night of Good Friday.
And so, part of the deadly die was cast. A simple decision to attend the theater. That a figure would be lurking in the shadow with intent to kill could not be known for sure. But this question would be left to the historians. What mattered at this point, the second week of April 1865, was that the drama had already begun to unfold. It was a drama that would shock a nation already shattered by civil war. And who were the men who were writing this drama? It's a tale that revolves around more than one man, that revolves around more than one scheme. There was John Wilkes Booth, celebrated actor, with a mountainous pride and ego. There was Lewis Payne, strong as an ox, but stupid and bungling. There was George Andrew Atzerodt, a drunken lout who would swing at the end of a rope. There was Mary Surratt, the middle-aged keeper of a boarding house, whose body would also dangle from a hangman's noose. There was young David Harold, Booth's companion in flight, who would pay with his life for his misguided loyalty. And what of Sam Arnold and Dr. Samuel Mudd, who would see the inside of prison?
So you see, my good friends, it needn't be so complicated if we learn our duties well. Carry them off with dedication and precision.
But see here, John Wilkes, I can agree with you in principle, but that's all. You'll not catch me stalking into that damn theater with 1,000 idiots watching some play and expect me to kidnap the president under the eyes of them all. I wouldn't last for a half hour.
Without seeming impertinent, then, my dear friend, what does appeal to you? By what plan do you feel your soul can abide?
There's no need to sound so snippy about it. It's my neck, too, you know. I say we either capture him in the carriage when he goes to the old soldier's home, or you can count me out of it.
Sam Arnold, any man who talks of quitting should be shot. Do you hear? Shot.
Two can play at that game, you know.
And so, the men who had designs on the life of Lincoln weave their awful web. 4 days from now,
100 years ago tonight, Lincoln's bleeding body would slump forward in a red velvet chair in the presidential box at Ford's Theater. The conspirators were destined to succeed in their plans, and they were also destined to pay dearly for them. That story tomorrow night on CCO Radio, when we meet the plotters. Part 2 of The Last Days of Lincoln.